This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Thousands of men, women, and children are huddled in pup tents and mud in a squalid camp in the Greek town of Idomeni along the Macedonian border, as members of the European Union and Turkey work, as we speak, to try to seal a deal which could determine the migrants' fate and that of thousands of others who have entered Greece illegally. This hour, we discuss the plan that's on the table, what it means for European countries desperate to stem the flow of migrants, and who seem willing to strike a deal with Turkey, a country whose regime is increasingly authoritarian. We'll also get Amnesty International's take on the proposal, and we'll talk about Syria, the peace talks in Geneva, the Russian military pullback, and the future of the Assad regime. So lots to discuss this hour. And we're opening our phone lines a little bit early if you'd like to get in on the conversation. 888-477-9499. But first, we examine the potential deal between the European Union and Turkey. And joining us from Berlin is Allison Smail, New York Times bureau chief in Berlin. So glad to have you on Radio Times, Allison.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So where are EU-Turkey negotiations at this point?
I think they're at the point that which Chancellor Angela Merkel identified late last night. Difficult negotiations, and we'll see if they do manage actually to clinch a deal, because there are so many legal and other implications to sort out.
Allison, I've read that certain proposals are no longer automatically on the table. The EU was going to double the amount of aid it gave to Turkey to about 6 billion euros. It was going to move on possible membership to the EU and offer visa-free travel. Are those offers now linked to a number of conditions?
Well, I think that everybody needs to be mindful there was sort of always small print. There are 72 conditions, for instance, before one can free up the visa travel. Turkey's met probably less than 20 of those. Some of them are probably, you can probably swing a deal. Others, it would be more difficult. Similarly, the money, 3 billion euros, so more than $3 billion, was promised. Of that, only 35 million euros has so far been spent. So yes, there's the prospect of more money, but it probably won't be needed until 2017 at the earliest. So I think that it's a case of whittling everything down to what are the most important points. And I do think there's going to be considerable concern over the human rights implications, both for the idea of the mass deportation, as it were, of people from Greece to Turkey, and then also how are people going to be treated inside Turkey.
And
this
that was my next question.
Merkel says will be carefully monitored by the European Union.
So, Allison, we don't know at this point what exactly awaits the migrants if they are returned to Turkey in the terms of treatment of migrants?
Well, I think what clearly everybody does not want to see anybody treated badly. Everybody is in agreement that the camp that has sprung up at the Greek-Macedonian border is squalid and, frankly, an embarrassment for Europe, a very developed continent. People will be well treated, but not where they want to be. The difficulty here is, as the Germans say, people have an absolute right to be considered for asylum, have a right to be treated as dignified human beings, but they do not have the right to choose where they're going to get shelter. And what essentially Europe is now trying to do is break the business model of the smugglers, who have made billions and billions of dollars over the past year at least, in ferrying hundreds of thousands of people from Turkey to Greece, and then showing them how to march or take a bus or a train and get towards their country of destination in Europe, which in most cases is Germany. The Germans want to break that business model, but they don't want to treat people inhumanely. Those people who are now in Greece will eventually be shipped back to Turkey, is the idea under this plan. What is not quite clear is what kind of priority those existing refugees will get. It seems as if they will have to go to the back of the queue if they're Syrians. And if they're Iraqis, Afghans, or anybody else, they're going to have to wait a very long time to see whether their request for asylum is granted anywhere outside Turkey.
My understanding is that once migrants go back to Turkey, if they do, some might end up being returned to Syria. What would await them there?
Well, clearly, Syria is a country that is really in conflict. At the same time, you have, with the peace talks that are now going on, the first glimmers of hope that maybe after 5 years, this dreadful war will grind to an end. I cannot see European countries countenancing sending people back to war zones. Similarly, if, heaven forfend, the war goes on, and there was a particularly bloody battle, let's say, over Aleppo. This is not something that the Europeans are blind to. They realized they would have to come in with massive help to try and take care of refugees in Turkey or wherever, if that dreadful prospect came about.
Let's talk about what's happening in Turkey right now. President Erdogan is now calling on the country's parliament to redefine its anti-extremism law to include journalists, to include politicians, academics, and as we know, recently the largest newspaper there was seized. How do you read this turn of events in terms of human rights?
Well, clearly European countries are extremely squeamish about this. What has made Turkey the indispensable ally, however, is simply geography. I mean, by virtue of its location between Syria and the European Union, if you're going to try and reduce the flow of people coming into Europe, you do need Turkey's help. I don't think anybody misses the idea that Erdogan has chosen this particular moment to make further moves to apparently extend the state's control over media and over the judiciary. But we shall have to see what actually gets passed. I do think it behooves us to be a little cautious.
Membership in the EU is once seen as a carrot to induce Turkey to push through democratic reform. So now is the EU so desperate to resolve the migrant situation that democratic reform in Turkey is off the table?
No, I don't think it's off the table. And I do think that everybody is mentioning this to the Turks. However, I mean, there is a need, or at least the European leaders perceive a need, to cut a deal to reduce the flow. I do think it's important to emphasize they do not want to cut the flow of refugees off completely. And particularly Germany, I think, will be still ready to accept considerable numbers. But what the Germans seek is a system, and that they have so far been unable to devise. Whether this whole idea actually works is also open to question.
Allison, let's take a look at Germany, which has taken in the largest population of migrants. How are they faring in Germany? Is there work for them, shelter for them?
Definitely there is shelter. And in most cases, they seem to have managed to, I mean, they're not no longer so many refugees being housed in sort of mass shelters like sports halls. But it's a huge challenge. I think that most Germans are still really willing to help, but I think they do have serious doubts now about to what extent many of these newcomers would be able to integrate into Germany. Of course, the great unknown is, will they really need to? In the early 1990s, Germany played host to hundreds of thousands of, in fact, over 1 million easily, refugees from the Balkan Wars. Most of those people went home when peace, or a kind of peace, was forged in 1995. Whether most people would return to Syria, whether there is a city or a town or a home for them to return to, I think is unclear. So people here in Germany, yes, I think there still is basically a willingness to help everybody. And I think there's even a readiness to take in more refugees. But what they don't want to see is what they saw last fall, when in the space of, you know, a week, you would have tens of thousands pouring across one particular border crossing in Bavaria.
And Allison Smale, at the same time, a group called Alternative for Germany, which is said to be anti-immigrant, made some real headway in elections this past weekend. How do you read that?
I read that as an outgrowth of the fear that people will not integrate. I read it as particularly the strongest showing by that party was in a state in former communist East Germany, a state which has problems even now with the fact that its communist era industry died, jobs are not plentiful, and people are very resentful. I do think the whole process of looking at this refugee influx has highlighted differences in all sorts of ways in Germany. One of them is between the former communist East and the always democratic West. And this is an issue that cuts across age, religion, political affiliation, educational level. It is being debated every day, every hour, in families, in groups, at workplaces. I mean, it really is the number one topic of conversation. And one strong element of that conversation is the degree to which we have seen right-wing and racist attacks on facilities for refugees, on asylum shelters. And these have shocked many Germans, leading to a fundamental debate about what is the society's attitude. They thought that they had confronted their Nazi past, yet there seem to be young people willing to call on Nazi-like ideology to justify their behavior. So it's hard to overstate to you the degree to which this is problem number one, two, three, and four here.
Is Angela Merkel now vulnerable as chancellor?
I think she obviously is not as strong as she was, let's say, 9 months ago, when everything seemed to be sort of cruising along quite nicely. I mean, let's remember that Germany is by far the number one economy in Europe, and in contrast to other places, has a relatively low rate of unemployment. So Germans feel good about themselves. I think it's one reason why they were also very open to taking in people. But what changed is the gradual realization of how difficult it might be to absorb hundreds of thousands of people. And then the events on New Year's Eve in Cologne, when hundreds of young German women reported being assaulted and groped and grabbed by migrant men who we're really not sure who they were. Are they people who recently arrived? Have they been here longer? That's still being investigated, really, but it undermined people's belief that newcomers might be able to integrate easily.
How did Merkel handle that situation?
Well, I think, you know, she obviously came out and condemned it, but I would say that she hasn't spoken about it very fully. Interestingly, after last weekend's state elections, in which the Alternative for Germany did so well, she did then allow that this was one of the concerns, just as she said openly, obviously some people have a problem with Islam becoming more of a common religion here. Other people have a problem with the fact that the world is changing fast, that globalization is affecting all of us. These were things that she'd said before, but not quite brought directly into relation with voters until, indeed, the first test at the ballot box.
Alison Smail, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alison is the New York Times bureau chief in Berlin. And after the break, we're going to talk to Amnesty International's Averna McGowan. If you'd like, you can give us a call, 888-477-9499, to join the conversation. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. And we are focusing in part this hour on a potential deal between the European Union and Turkey, which could see thousands of migrants now in Greece sent back to Turkey in a refugee swap. Again, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. And joining us now from Brussels to give us her take on the proposal is Averna McGowan, Amnesty International's head of the European Institutions Office and Advocacy Director. Welcome, Averna.
Thank you very much for having me, Mary.
So, Averna, when the EU Turkey proposal was announced, Amnesty's Deputy Director for Europe and Central Asia said, quote, using Turkey as a safe third country is absurd. Why is that?
So we just have to be very clear. Amnesty International strongly contests the concept of a safe country in general because it undermines an individual right to have asylum claims fully and fairly processed. Now, when we move from the general to the particular, and that's the case of Turkey, there is huge cause for concern given the current situation and treatment of migrants and refugees in the country. Amnesty International has repeatedly documented Turkey forcibly returning refugees to Syria back across the Turkish border, and refugees in the country live in really desperate conditions. They don't have adequate housing, children can't have access to education. So by no stretch of the imagination can Turkey possibly be considered a safe country for the purpose of returning some of these, the world's most vulnerable people.
So Ivorna, how would you characterize the EU's apparent willingness to use Turkey as a quote-unquote safe third country?
Well, it's an absolutely appalling approach to take. As a global human rights organization, Amnesty International is concerned about the international impact of this. You know, refugee law historically has arisen in recognition of the fact that refugees and migrants are the most vulnerable people. They have no votes, they have no constituency in the place they arrive. So the International Convention pushes for international solidarity, that wherever shore you land on, you have a right to asylum, a right to protection. So the notion of just trying to blanket stop people from having that access to the right in Europe and return them to Turkey, a country that is by no means safe, is deeply worrying.
Have we lost our line with Ivorna? Well, we are trying to discuss a situation with somebody who is calling from Brussels. So let's see if we can renegotiate that line. But I'm being told now that we do have Aaron Stein, who is Senior Resident Fellow at Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So what is your take on the proposed EU deal with Turkey, Aaron?
I mean, it's certainly been a long time in the making. And I don't think it actually addresses the fundamental problem, which is the illegal migration of people from Syria through Turkey onto the Greek islands trying to enter the European Union zone. I mean, the deal obviously provides some incentives, primarily for Angela Merkel, because it begins at least politically for her to show that she's sending some of the refugees back to Turkey. But you'll still have problems within the Eurozone itself, because for every one of those migrants that would be returned to Turkey, the EU would then have to resettle one from Turkey itself into one of the EU member countries. And that's been problematic for them about how to disperse these Syrian refugees and where to place them across the Union writ large.
Again, there are questions, Aaron, about the fact that President Erdogan is an increasingly authoritarian leader in Turkey. And how do you see the EU's willingness to make Turkey a safe spot, work with Turkey in this situation to take refugees, as opposed to, some say, advancing democratic progress in Turkey? What's your take on that?
Well, clearly this is a transactional agreement, in that the EU is willing to overlook some of the problems that are going on inside Turkey for its own benefit, really. I mean, this has become a political problem for numerous European leaders. And so Turkey becomes an easy way out for them to try and at least show movement to their own population, who are growing concerned about the number of Syrian refugees that are entering their country. They have chosen to overlook what's going on inside Turkey, and the Turks know this. And then so they're using this to their own advantage to try and hasten both the accession negotiations that are ongoing and to get something that they've always wanted. And that they've always domestically complained about, which is that they are the only EU accession country whose citizens are not allowed visa-free travel to the European Union. And so this is clearly something that the Turks want, particularly by June, for a number of domestic political reasons. And so Erdogan and his prime minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, are playing a very strong hand here against a weakened European Union.
So would you go as far as to say that it smacks of desperation on the part of the EU?
I wouldn't say it's desperation. I mean, I just think this is a very realist terms, you know, political agreement that's transactional. But I think that's indicative of something far broader. It's that the EU-Turkey relationship is now transactional. It's no longer about a shared vision, one would say, about marching forward to accession. I mean, the negotiations have been going on for quite some time now with very little progress. But when there's a way that they can move on for mutual political expediency, the two sides can come together and at least hammer out a very hard-fought agreement problematic as it is, but nevertheless transactionally beneficial for both sides.
So as we mentioned at the top of the hour, negotiations are ongoing this hour between the EU and Turkey. And as you just mentioned, you believe Turkey has a strong hand. What do you think might come out of this at the end of the day? Will Turkey win visa-free travel? Will it win, I've heard, as many as 6 billion euros to help in the refugee situation? Will it ultimately win membership in the European Union?
Well, one by one, I think the money allocated will definitely happen. I mean, I think 3 billion euros have already been allocated, and there's the promise of another 3 billion to help facilitate the arrangements of this deal. The visa-free travel, I think, will be problematic, to be quite frank. Turkey
Why
has
is that?
To meet a number of benchmarks, I believe 72, while the Turkish EU foreign minister, the Turkish minister for the European Union affairs has said that Turkey will readily move to enact all of these reforms. It's unclear if they'll be able to do so by June, and that could lead to another set of negotiations in June about whether or not Turkey has lived up to its obligations. Now, in the longer term, about whether or not Turkey is on the glide path for European Union membership in the near term, I don't see it, actually. There's a number of hurdles continuing. You have concurrent issues about Cyprus and a number of questions about rule of law issues inside Turkey that will have to be dealt with in the longer term. So essentially what I see this agreement is kicking the can down the road, opening a few chapters, and then being a transactional relationship to deal with the near-term crisis for the European Union and Turkey, which is the growing number of refugees.
So a car bomb killed 37 people in Ankara recently. Turkey blames the Kurdistan Workers' Party. President Erdogan is now calling on the country's parliament to redefine its anti-extremism law. We talked about this a little bit with Alison Smale a couple moments ago, but this redefinition would include, you know, journalists and politicians and academics. And recently, Zaman, the largest newspaper in Turkey, was seized. How do you interpret this turn of events? What is going on within Turkey?
I mean, there's deep anger inside Turkey about what's going on. And what they see, at least from the Turkish government side, is a restart of a Kurdish insurgency by the PKK in the southeast, beginning in last July, and that this latest bombing is just the latest extension of it. And so in order to deal with what they're calling an internal war on terror, Turkey has to take steps to disempower those that provide propaganda for terror groups. This is their words. And so there's this desire to at least expand already very loose counterterror laws in order to try and undercut members of the Kurdish-dominated People's Democratic Party inside parliament, as well as some opposition media outlets who do espouse a pro-PKK line. Obviously, any movement towards narrowing freedom of expression is worrying in any democratic country. And so this is, in my opinion, a mistake on the Turkish government side because it feeds the PKK's narrative that they are fighting for the rights of oppressed people rather than being labeled as terrorists, as they should be.
There was a tough crackdown on protesters in 2013, and President Erdogan has been compared by some to Vladimir Putin. A fair comparison in your mind?
I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, obviously, different countries are different. But obviously, this is the mood inside Turkey is that Erdogan is making moves to centralize power and that in what should be a prime ministry and parliamentary system has now become de facto presidential. Now, Erdogan has used this to strengthen his arguments that he needs to centralize powers more, change the constitution and enact a strengthened presidential system that really they claim is similar to ours here in the United States, but it's not because it's not. It wouldn't be a federal system. You would still have a very centralized governing structure and only a unicameral legislature. So this raises obvious concerns about checks and balances. But again, I mean, this is the debate that the Turks are having at the moment, and there are very sharp arguments against the presidential system. And Erdogan, to this day, has yet to go over 50% publicly support for this proposed move.
And Ehrenstein, as you mentioned, fighting continues between the Turkish, I guess, the army and in the southeast and Kurdish insurgents. Does Europe need to take a stronger stand on that conflict?
I mean, this is part and parcel to the transactional relationship of the refugee deal, is that you're overlooking what's going on in the southeast for political expediency back home. Traditionally, most Western countries, the United States and the European Union, have chosen to overlook the PKK problem. We've looked at it as this is a Turkish internal matter. This is Turkey's own problem, and so Turkey has the strength and power to do something about it. The difference this time around is that you have a concurrent civil war going on inside Syria, where the United States has allied very closely with an affiliate to the PKK, the Democratic Union Party, the PYD, inside Syria, who has become the vanguard, sort of ground force against the Islamic State, and has made considerable gains. And so by prosecuting the war against the Islamic State in the way that we are here in the United States, we have sort of interjected ourselves into this very nasty domestic Turkish-Kurdish issue that is now really heating up in the southeast.
Mm. According to Amnesty International, a few dozen people are being held in an airport detention cell in Istanbul, including a Syrian man, apparently for over a year. Who is monitoring the government in this sort of thing?
Well, that's one of the problems, I think, with the EU deal, is that the way that refugees are classified in Turkey is that they aren't actually classified as refugees. Turkey has a carve-out in terms of the way it interprets the Geneva Convention on refugees. And so it treats Syrians as, quote unquote, guests. Now, they will be given more rights in this refugee deal, perhaps to work, issuing work permits. But there are lots of caveats involved in that in terms of where they can work, where they can travel inside of Turkey. And so one of the criticisms of this deal is that by sending these people back to Turkey, they become legally nebulous. There's no sort of overarching structure that watches out for them. And this guy who's been living in the airport lounge, basically the airport hotel for the past year, is a good example of that. And this is something that will need to be taken up in the next year and really in the longer term, because nobody quite knows how many refugees are in Syria. The official number is 2.7, although that number is problematic for a number of reasons, 2.7 million, but that number is problematic for a number of reasons. And so these people will be in Turkey for the long term. And so the government will have to deal with this issue beyond just the immediacy of this EU deal and in the longer term of the Syrian civil conflict.
So, Aaron, the EU is asking migrants to stay in Turkey, those who are there now. How is this message being delivered? Are asylum seekers actually receiving it, or do they just don't want to hear it?
I mean, they are receiving it, but, you have now an incentive for people to try and make the illegal crossing to Greece as fast as possible. Again, because these people don't have specific legal guarantees governing their stay inside Turkey, the concern amongst many of them is that the Turkish government could at one point just change its mind and then say, you're no longer welcome. Now, that's probably not going to happen, but nevertheless, if you're a Syrian refugee who's fleeing conflict, this becomes something you would be afraid of, especially if you have a family. And so there becomes an incentive to cross to Greece and to get to Germany, because at least in Germany you'll be welcome, and then you can work and you can make money. And so that becomes the overarching issue that drives illegal immigration into the Eurozone. Obviously, they're going to try and cut this off, and in exchange, Turkey will grant some of these people work permits, but it doesn't solve the fundamental problem, is that people will want to still get to the European Union because it provides more opportunity, just a higher earning income potential. And, in many cases, they have family who have already moved up into basically Germany, France, and some of the northern countries.
Do we know what percentage of these migrants are being manipulated by human traffickers?
It's unclear. I mean, but the human trafficking industry, I mean, Turkey and globally is thriving at the moment. I mean, there are very well-established networks inside Turkey that move people from these border towns out to the coast and then arrange for their travel across into Greece. The amount of money we're talking about is in the tens of millions, if not in the hundreds of millions of dollars to facilitate this trade. And for my money, or at least in the open source, there's not any serious understanding of where all this money goes.
And so is the Turkish government turning a blind eye to traffickers?
I don't think so. I mean, it's just a massive problem. Certainly, they
cracked
down harder.
How do they operate, Aaron? Do you know?
In recent months since the beginning of the European Union negotiations. But the problem is immense for the Turkish government. I mean, one should not underestimate the sheer scale of numbers inside Turkey, the constraints that places on Turkish both security policymakers and members of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then downward towards the police officers who have to then try and roll up these networks. Certainly, there are reports of graft involved and these police officers being paid off to look the other way. But I would say that that sort of overlooks, or that narrative overlooks, the scale of the problem and the longer-term issues posed by these millions of people now living inside Turkey.
All right, we're coming up in a break. So we're examining the proposed European deal with Turkey, the refugee swap, smugglers, and we will also be talking about the Syrian peace talks underway in Geneva. Our guest for the rest of this hour is Aaron Stein, Senior Resident Fellow at Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. And if you'd like to jump into the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Email radiotimes at whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. More just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Aaron Stein is our guest. He is Senior Resident Fellow at Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. And lines are open. Calls are coming in at 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes at whyy.org. Or a tweet works as well at WHYY Radio Times. And Aaron, let's get right to the phones. Catherine in Allentown has been standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Catherine.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would be interested in knowing the views of your guest about the United States, how the European people and governments and people view the United States' role in all this terrible refugee crisis, in view of the fact that we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and the issue in Syria. We're backing the Saudis when they're bombing Yemen and all. And whether they feel that we should have taken our share, which we're not, of refugees.
Thank you for the call, Catherine. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, the United States doesn't come up much in these negotiations because this is primarily between the European Union and Turkey. But I will say inside Turkey, there's a deep anger with the United States about what they perceive as inaction in Syria. So it's not that the United States is not militarily engaged inside Syria and that its military action doesn't also produce certain amounts of people fleeing across the border. It's that if the United States would have intervened earlier on behalf of the Syrian rebels that Turkey very much supports, then you wouldn't have such the scale of the refugee crisis ongoing as it is now. And then if you link it to what's going on in Turkey's southeast, which is the problems with its own Kurdish population and how we are, the United States is supporting the Syrian Kurdish PYD in its war against ISIS, the Turkish government is very much of the opinion that giving sole support to the PYD is a bad idea, because as they expand their territory, into Arab and Turkmen and other minority areas inside Syria, and that prompts more refugees to then flee across the border into Turkey. And so by not being more forceful in our intervention, Turkey thinks that we're contributing to the refugee crisis. And in doing so, we're also undermining the European Union, in fact, one of our most important allies, Angela Merkel. That's the Turkish position. So that is the way that they tie in the United States here.
And let's go to David in Flemington. David, you're live on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you, Mary and Aaron. Just two questions. What is the significance of visa-free travel? And secondly, does a visa increase security over a passport alone? Thank you.
Thanks, David. Aaron?
I mean, for the Turkish government, the idea has always been that the visa provides a lot of hurdles, especially for business people, to go back and forth into the Union, where Turkey does a lot of trade, and just for general tourism. I mean, just as somebody who lived in Turkey for a very long time, the visa process is not a fun process, especially if you want to go visit Paris as a Turkish citizen for the weekend. More broadly, certainly there are risks associated with just the Schengen arrangement in general. But what I would say is that once you're in the Union, you're able to basically move anywhere. And so that the visa process does probably provide an extra layer of security. But I'm not sure how much. And once you're in the Union, as European Union officials will tell you, they lose track of people quite easily. So I'm not sure how it would change all that much.
Aaron Stein, let's turn to Syria. And the peace talks are ongoing, I understand, in Geneva. Russian warplanes began leaving Tuesday, and Russian President Putin is withdrawing most military forces from Syria. How does this affect the peace negotiations?
Well, I mean, to be clear, he is leaving a sizable contingent of his ground forces and his air force inside Syria, although the pace and scope of Russian bombing is expected to decrease in line with the recently negotiated cessation of hostilities with the United States. This is widely interpreted as a signal by the Russian president to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad that he has to be serious about negotiating this time around, that he doesn't have a Russian guarantee over his security forever. Now, here, the devil will be in the details. It's how do you deal with Bashar al-Assad's long-term future? The United States would like to see him go in a phased transition, whereas the Russians have always been more flexible and have been pushing for the ability for him to stand again in re-election. And this will be where, you know, the two sides will disagree and disagree vehemently. And behind the United States, you will have extreme disagreement and displeasure from a number of its allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the Qataris, but others, about even Assad being able to stay on for that 6 months. So there are a lot of roadblocks in the way of any peaceful negotiations. Smart money is that these negotiations will fail. But nevertheless, Russia does appear to be signaling that it's committed to at least observing the cessation of hostilities and negotiating. Whether it will negotiate in good faith remains, you know, only the future will tell.
So what does Vladimir Putin really think of Bashar al-Assad, in your opinion?
I mean, I think he's a problematic ally. I mean, but most great powers have problematic allies. Syria has become a vestige for the Russians to continue to project power into the Levant. I would call him a problematic ally for Russia and a close ally of Iran. But nevertheless, problematic for Iran as well. And this is where it gets into the larger dynamics at play here. It's how do you negotiate a withdrawal or at least a removal of Assad when its two most important backers, Russia and Iran, would like him to stay on board. And this becomes where you become at loggerheads and the negotiations break down and you have extreme disagreement between the multiple parties involved.
So just one quick question backwards here. Did Putin's move to withdraw military forces from Syria come as a surprise to you? Came as a surprise to so many, but were you taken aback by that?
Yes. I mean, they were having quite a considerable amount of success, in at least the way that they were prosecuting the war and to their own political end goals, which is to empower Bashar al-Assad. Now, again, he hasn't removed the bulk of his military forces. They still have a very capable small force in there, and that force can still project power. And so I think it was a deft political move, and he can, you know, continue to at least hold the veto or at least the threat of continued military action to then frame or at least push their side of the political negotiations as we move forward in the coming weeks and months.
All right, Aaron, let's get to the Kurds in Syria. They've declared the creation of a federal region. I think it's in the northern part of the country. The U.S., Turkey, and the Syrian government have apparently warned against this. Is that correct? And what does this do to efforts to stabilize Syria?
Well, the U.S. has come out and said it will not recognize what the PYD or the Syrian Kurds are calling a democratic federal region. Now, the PYD has always indicated that it will go down this path, but it doesn't want to actually break away from a Syrian state. What they would want is autonomy for their own regions with local councils based upon the ideology that they espouse, which is very Marxist and anarchistic. And that they would like this to be the model of governance for all of Syria, but as an ideal, but they will accept it in the Kurdish areas. The United States, the Turks, the Syrian central government, and most view this as unhelpful because most Syrians involved don't want to see the breakup of their state. And so this actually, from the U.S. perspective, despite our close military ties, undermines the political track that, you know, Secretary of State John Kerry is leading to try and negotiate that phased transition with Bashar al-Assad and the Russians and the Iranians and all of his various backers.
So in your opinion, then, will the federal region stand?
Well, you know, that will something to be negotiated, and that gets back to Kurdish motivations in this. The Kurds are not going to be included at the Geneva peace negotiations for a number of reasons, primarily because of the Turkish veto. And so they continue to push the ball down the road to make sure that their voice is heard and that their demands are taken into account in any type of settlement of the Syrian issue. They would like to see a federal, decentralized Syrian state. They have won support for that idea from Russia for a number of reasons. And John Kerry has even hinted at that could be the United States' quote-unquote plan B if the favored negotiations with Bashar to keep the state intact don't move forward as we would like them to. So they see an opportunity here for their own self-interests. They realize they have a close relationship with the United States, and so they see no better time than to continue to push forward with their with their overarching desire, which is to create this autonomous region for themselves.
So, Aaron, what are the odds that the plan B will be the plan that actually materializes here?
I mean, that's really too early to say. I mean, predicting the future will only get me in trouble because I probably won't be right. But, you know, clearly the state is fractured and divided over these competing claims of territory from these various groups fighting. That includes the regime. And one way or the other, these different territories will either have to be brought together or their differences recognized in a future post-Assad Syrian government. How that government looks will be up to the people involved in the negotiations. But that's the question that the Kurds just want to push the ball forward and say, well, you're just going to have to take us seriously and just write us into whatever sort of agreement you have.
Aaron Stein, if there is eventually stability in Syria, even if it is under Assad, with the world watching, does this, in your opinion, affect the flow of refugees out of Syria or migrants out of Syria?
Well, what does happen inside most of the refugees inside Turkey is that when areas are cleared of ISIS and spared from regime bombing, they do want to go back home. I mean, this is obviously these people's homes. They have lives there. They have family. They have roots. They want to go back home. So you could imagine a scenario whereby a fraction or at least a percentage of the refugees would like to go back home if the fighting stops. Now, I think the vast majority of the people just want peace and at this point are willing to accept pretty much anything just to get back into their houses. But I think the people with guns and the people who are calling the shots militarily on both sides, the rebel and the Assad side, are not finished yet and would like to continue to try and maximize their own gains so that they can try and push their own desired end goals. And so I'm afraid to say I see more conflict on the horizon, which will lead to more refugees leaving the country and those that are already outside of the country not being able to return.
So those Syrians who remain to this day, then there is not much of a sense of hope, even in light of the Geneva talks and the recent ceasefire?
I mean, I think hope is the wrong word. I mean, I think what they're trying to do is make the best out of their own terrible situation. And so they're looking for pockets of stability where they can go live. I mean, keep in mind that we focus on refugees. There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of IDPs inside Syria. Some living in Kurdish areas, some living in rebel-controlled areas, some living in the regime areas, who are just trying to flee fighting.
So characterize the grip of ISIS in Syria these days.
Well, I mean, it remains strong in the eastern part of the countries, but there's no doubt it's weakening. I mean, there is actually two wars going there are actually two wars going on inside Syria at the moment. There is the northwestern war, which the Russians were prosecuting, and the northeastern war, which the United States was prosecuting. If you look, focus on the U.S. war against ISIS, it's actually going pretty well. The Kurds have made serious gains, and ISIS is coming under pressure in numerous areas inside of Syria. And its territorial control is lessening. Now, with that said, there still remains huge hurdles that the U.S. will have to get over. One is to take the de facto capital of Raqqa and to close the final remaining pocket along the Turkish border where ISIS still has a presence. There are political sensitivities involved in the latter because the force that would need to do that are Syrian Kurds, of which Turkey views as terrorists. And so you have political disagreements that are slowing down the war plan, particularly in the areas west of the Euphrates River out to the city of Azaz, right along the border with Turkey.
So Turkey's Prime Minister Davutoğlu recently called for a safe zone in Syria for migrants. How realistic is that prospect?
That's been the Turkish policy since 2012. I mean, that's ideally how they would like to deal with this, was always to carve out a safe zone under the cover of a no-fly zone led by the United States, but with which Turkey would participate along with members of the European Union and the Arab world. The U.S. has never been willing to fully implement that idea, but Turkey nevertheless continues to advocate it as the best way forward. The safe zone has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, admittedly, and so now Turkey is looking at areas right opposite its border, where there are about 80,000 refugees at the moment lined up trying to cross into Turkey. But Turkey actually has its border closed. It actually has since March 2015. And so is providing aid across the border to these people. But these people don't have protection from the air and don't have protection from the rebel groups on the ground, although the rebel groups have largely left them alone. And so that becomes the issue for Turkey as they move forward.
All right, back to the phones. Frank in Center City, you're live on Radio Times. Hello, Frank.
Yes, hi. My question or proposal is, why not offer the Kurds a carrot? Support them to have autonomy, territorial and governmental. within Iraq, which they've always been at loggerheads with the Iraq government before the war, and they would be a tremendous counterbalance to the Shias and the Sunnis who have fought and who we should never have gotten involved with, and deny them anything in Syria, get out of Syria, go back to Iraq, have your own space, and get out of the hair of the Turkish government, too, in that respect. And I think it would be a tremendous counterbalance to the fighting between the Sunnis and the Shia in Iraq.
Well, Frank, we're running a little short on time, so I'll have to stop you there. Thank you so much. And Aaron, what do you think?
You get into Kurdish alphabet soup, but the group fighting in Syria is the PYD, which is an affiliate of the PKK, is actually at odds with the dominant Kurdish faction inside the Kurdistan Regional Government inside of Iraq, which is the KDP. And so you have, besides Turkish-Kurdish, Syrian-Kurdish tensions, you have Kurdish-Kurdish-Kurdish tensions that play out and would probably not allow for this type of this scenario to unfold. With that said, you know, Turkey has very close relationship with the KRG and this KDP, and would like them actually to infiltrate inside to Syria to dilute the power of the PKK. So the other way around. So again, a complicated situation, but probably not feasible in the near term.
And Aaron, a quick question to wrap us up here regarding the migrant crisis. Do you think, I'm asking your opinion here, are we talking months or years until it's resolved? And I won't hold you to it.
Years.
Years.
I mean, years. I mean, the conflict isn't ending probably anytime soon. And even when it does, these people will have to go home. And then they will be going home to a country that's absolutely destroyed.
Aaron Stein, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aaron is Senior Resident Fellow at Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times.